Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to this podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I'm Patrick Wyman, and this is The Fall of Rome. Sorry for the delay in posting this third episode of The Fall of Rome. My wife and I had a baby last week, so I've been a little bit busy, but we'll now resume our regular schedule. This week, we'll examine what happened when the Goths first entered the Roman Empire in 376 AD, a chain of events that led directly to the greatest Roman military disaster in more than 350 years at the Battle of Adrianople. An emperor died on the battlefield, and an entire field army, the cream of the Roman military, found themselves in early graves. How did this happen? How did a group of ragtag refugees bring a superpower to such a crushing defeat? We'll explore all of that and more. In last week's episode, we explored the world beyond the frontiers of the Roman Empire, the barbarian world, from the beginning of the 3rd century to around 375 AD. We focused on the Goths, one particular group of barbarians who occupied the area that stretched some 800 miles from central Romania to the easternmost tip of the Ukraine, from the Carpathian Mountains to the open grass of the Eurasian steppe. This was a diverse and complex world, which the Romans called Barbaricum, the land of the barbarians. It was densely populated, with villages consisting of neat rows of round, sunken-floored huts, and square timber houses, surrounded by fields of wheat, barley, and millet. On the open plains, semi-nomadic groups moved cattle from grazing area to grazing area and raised horses. Germanic-speaking Goths lived alongside Latin and Iranian speakers and other groups besides. Followers of the traditional gods lived alongside a growing number of converted Christians, either imports from the Roman Empire or converted Goths. Now, the Goths dominated this region politically. Powerful aristocrats, whether we want to call them kings, lords, or tribal chieftains, kept war bands of well-trained and well-equipped followers. The average villagers weren't necessarily fond of them, and these big men and their private armies were becoming increasingly important. This wasn't a static world. The rich and powerful were becoming more so on the strength of these war bands, and the material culture of the region was evolving at a rapid pace. Most of all, though, we have to bear in mind on the most basic level that the world beyond the frontier can't be understood in isolation from the Roman world. Those Gothic big men received Roman monetary subsidies in return for maintaining some measure of order beyond the frontier, and they then distributed that money to their followers in return for military service. When they raided south of the Danube into Roman territory, it was generally because they were looking for a better deal. These lords or chieftains expressed their power through imported Roman goods, ranging from vast quantities of imported wine, to glass windows, to terracotta roof tiles, to more practical items like swords and metalwork. A great many of the Goths, especially those belonging to this class of warrior retainers and big men, would have had even closer first-hand experience of the Roman world. The Roman army was always hungry for new recruits, and just across the frontier sat a large body of trained, skilled warriors whose services were available for hire. Some Goths joined the army individually, signing up for 25-year stints and then settling in Roman territory when their service was done. Others joined as whole units, hired out by these big men as ready-made groups of mercenaries who might serve for a year, 5 years, or a decade before returning home. Roman merchants were a common sight in barbarian territory, and Gothic merchants did business in Roman territory as well. The two regions were closely linked economically. Archaeologists have found more bronze Roman coins in the region just north of the mouth of the Danube, barbarian territory, than they have to the south in Roman territory. Beyond the frontier, Gothic farming villages produced excess wheat and livestock to feed the Roman border forts. On every level, the Gothic world and the Roman world were closely tied together. When the Huns arrived on the scene in the early 370s and started to raid into Gothic territory, and eventually invaded wholesale, that was the context that led to the appearance of a large number of Gothic refugees on the Danube. These refugees begged for entry into the empire, promising military service in return for safe passage. Last week, we followed the story of a Goth named Vulfila, an imaginary character who can serve as a stand-in to humanize the abstract processes of social change and large-scale events. Vulfila was a warrior, someone who had served in the Roman army, like so many of his compatriots from beyond the frontier. In 376, when the Goths showed up on the Danube asking for entry, he would have been in his mid-30s. What the Goths were asking for from the Romans wasn't a novel idea from the perspective of either party, and Vulfila, as a former soldier, would have seen it happen on numerous occasions. There was even a long-standing technical term in Latin for this process, receptio. This was a voluntary submission of an immigrant group of whatever size to Roman authority and power. This happened constantly along the empire's frontiers. Small groups of barbarians would petition for entry and swear oaths of allegiance in an organized process overseen by the army. These immigrants would either agree to provide military service, to occupy deserted farmland, or some combination of the two, depending on the local context and the needs of the army. Some historians would say that the scale of the Goths' entry into the empire in 376 was something new, that their sheer numbers set them apart from other barbarian groups that had petitioned to be let in. But even that isn't really the case. First, there had been plenty of other sizable groups admitted to the empire before. The Carpi, a tribe that had inhabited the area beyond the Danube for centuries, was defeated militarily and then brought into the empire en masse in several waves between the 270s and the 320s, after which point they were completely assimilated. The famous Emperor Constantine brought in the remnants of the Sarmatians in 334 AD under similar circumstances. And that last incident would have taken place within the living memory of elderly people along the border when the Goths arrived. Second, it's impossible to tell precisely how many Goths showed up on the banks of the Danube. Roman commentators spoke of vast numbers. Ammianus said the troops ferrying them across the river lost count, and he quotes a snippet of a poem comparing them to grains of sand in the desert. Another source says 200,000. These figures are absurdly large, though. Remember, it's not like every single person living in Gothic-controlled territory, or even all of the Goths, packed up and moved out. The refugees were Goths, but they weren't the Goths as an entire people. Moreover, the long-term consequences of letting the Goths in were so strikingly enormous that Roman authors had every reason to inflate their numbers. 15,000 to 20,000 warriors like Vulfila and their dependents, their family, their slaves, and so on and so forth, is a good estimate. And that would put the total somewhere between 30,000 and 50,000. Now, this was still a substantial population movement, but not the entirety of an ethnic group on the move. The Goths didn't simply show up and start crossing the frontier. Remember, this was a fortified border with major military bases at regular intervals and tens of thousands of troops manning them. The Danube itself isn't exactly a creek either. Moreover, the Goths were looking for a managed entry into the empire, not an invasion in the face of military resistance. The Huns, as far as we can tell, weren't nipping right at their heels. In other words, this group wasn't looking for entry because of immediate danger. By all accounts, this group of Goths was looking for a long-term settlement. They were trying to negotiate, as near equals, with Roman officials. They had something the Romans wanted: trained military manpower. The Romans had something they wanted: safety from the Huns and access to the Roman world behind a fortified border. Agreements like this don't happen in a context of culture shock. The Goths weren't strangers to the militarized world of the frontier, but regular participants in it. And the only way to make sense of this organized process of immigration is through the lens of regular interactions where both sides understood the basic rules of the game. Pay attention to how the Roman historian Ammianus Marcellinus, our best source for this sequence of events, describes them. Quote, "Therefore, under the lead of Olavivus, they took possession of the banks of the Danube. and sending envoys to Valens with humble entreaty begged to be received, promising that they would not only lead a peaceful life, but would also furnish auxiliaries if circumstances required. End quote. The process of receptio involved formal submission. It had to be approved by the emperor, and it involved a straightforward exchange of service for settlement. That's exactly what Ammianus tells us happened here. Now listen to Ammianus' statements about the Romans' reasoning. Quote, "The affair caused more joy than fear, and experienced flatterers immoderately praised the good fortune of the prince, which unexpectedly brought him so many young recruits from the ends of the earth, that by the union of his own and foreign forces he would have an invisible army. Also, that instead of the levy of soldiers, which was contributed annually by each province, there would accrue to the treasuries a vast amount of gold." So let's break this down a bit. The prince in question here is the Roman emperor, Valens, whom we first met in last week's episode when he was ineffectually invading Gothic territory beyond the Danube. He had imposed a peace treaty on the Goths that helped to ruin the economy by limiting trade between the empire and the Goths' region of control. The political instability that resulted provides the context in which the Huns ended Gothic political rule over the Santana de Muresh Chernyakov region. How do Valens and his advisors read that instability beyond the border? As an opportunity for the Romans to exploit. Remember, the Romans were keen observers of what happened in Barbaricum, in the barbarian world, and did their best to poke and prod with money, threats, and military force. Instability there produced both a lack of coherent threat to Rome and a surplus of military recruits. Moreover, that surplus of new soldiers from beyond the border meant that instead of demanding troops from the great landlords of the empire, Valens could tax them more heavily instead. Now, some historians have argued that the Goths got a particularly favorable deal from the Romans in comparison to other instances of receptio, with more choice of the place where they'd be settled on farmland, and more concentrated settlements to maintain their ethnic and political identity. I don't see any real reason to believe that, though. It's reading too much into limited evidence, and we don't know all that much about the specifics of previous receptiones either. The fact that we don't hear from the Carpi, to name one group, after they entered the empire probably has as much to do with the fact that our surviving sources literally don't care about them as with an attempt to forcibly integrate them into Roman society. All in all, it's hard to put ourselves in Valens' shoes and see anything other than a win-win here. From the Goths' perspective, it was absolutely a win-win as well. Now let's think about this from Vulfila's point of view for a moment. You've served in the Roman army, so that particular term of the agreement isn't intimidating. You've known Roman officials for most of your life, you've dealt with them during your time in the army and then afterward along the frontier. You have some command of the Latin language, and these frontier provinces where you'd be settled are close to your homeland anyway. It'd just be one more step in a process of integration into the Roman world, a process that had already been well underway for generations. Unfortunately for the Romans, and for many of the Goths as well, things didn't go as planned.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
The scheme to admit, process, and settle the Goths broke down almost immediately. Two Gothic leaders, Olavive and Fritigern, had negotiated this deal with the Emperor Valens, and Roman officials in place along the border were supposed to make it run smoothly. The Romans would deliver food for immediate consumption, and then begin the longer-term process of settling the Goths on viable farmland, presumably near the border. According to Ammianus, the blame falls on the two Roman leaders assigned to oversee the process, Lupicinus and Maximus. Here's what Ammianus says, quote, "Their treacherous greed was the source of all our evils. I say nothing of other crimes which these two men, or at least others with their permission, with the worst of motives, committed against the foreign newcomers, who were as yet blameless. But one melancholy and unheard of act shall be mentioned, of which, even if they were the own judges of their own case, they could not be acquitted by any excuse. When the barbarians after their crossing were harassed by lack of food, those most hateful generals devised a disgraceful traffic. They exchanged every dog that their insatiability could gather from far and wide for one slave each. And among these were carried off also sons of the chieftains." So Lupicinus and Maximus not only didn't deliver the promised food according to the terms of the deal. According to Ammianus, they literally exchanged dogs, a rhetorical stand-in for the worst possible supplies, for slaves. The highest ranks of the Goths were every bit as subject to this as the lowest ranks. Even if this is an exaggeration, as some historians have suggested, and to be honest, I don't really see any reason to think that it is, it's still a horrifying situation. In other words, Lupicinus and Maximus turned a standard settlement deal for a group of barbarians into an opportunity for corruption and graft on a massive scale. That in itself isn't particularly surprising. Late Roman civilian and military officials expected to profit from their offices, but the brazenness of the effort, the lack of care for the consequences, and the incompetence with which it was handled certainly were surprising. The sources make clear that the Romans disarmed the Goths when they crossed the Danube, and some historians have suggested that deliberately limiting the Goths' supplies was a way to keep them under control. That's plausible enough, but if so, things quickly got out of hand. While this was happening, another group of Goths showed up on the barbarian side of the Danube. In last week's episode, we discussed the divisions within the Goths. Those who fled into the empire in 376 and who were currently suffering the short end of the Roman stick belonged to the Tervingi, meaning something like forest dwellers, and they were the more western group. The Greutungi, meaning steppe dwellers, lived to the east, and it was members of the Greutungi who now showed up on the Danube as Roman officials were busy shortchanging the Goths on the Roman side of the river. As the Tervingi had, the Greutungi asked for entry into the empire, presumably under the same terms of settlement and safety in return for military service. The Emperor Valens flatly turned them down. Perhaps he thought he had enough new potential soldiers. It's also possible he feared what would happen if he let another group into the empire so quickly. He might have wanted to let them stew for a while, dealing first with the Tervingi and only later admitting the Greutungi. Or maybe he wanted to make a point about the absolute power of Rome, letting one group in while letting another wither away on the frontier. It could have been a combination of all of them. We'll never know the answer. The Greutungi hunkered down on the Danube, waiting for an opportunity. While they did so, things were going poorly further south. Lupicinus and Maximus, the Roman officials, sensed the Tervingi's growing and totally understandable unrest. What was their solution? Lupicinus invited the Goths' leaders, Olivive and Fritigern, to a banquet in the city of Marcianople. The Goths were camped outside the city, while Roman soldiers refused to let them in to purchase supplies. The slave traders were still at it, too, so tensions were running high. Brawls broke out between the Goths and the soldiers, understandably given the circumstances. Now, there was nothing particularly unusual about a Roman official inviting barbarian leaders to a banquet, particularly when those barbarian leaders were about to become officers in the Roman army leading a substantial contingent of troops. But banquets also had a long history as an opportunity for treachery, both within Roman society as a whole and specifically in Roman dealings with barbarian leaders. That's exactly what happened here. With Olivive and Fritigern at the banquet, tensions boiled over, and a group of Goths killed a body of Roman troops, perhaps as a result of the tender attentions of the slave traders. Ammianus' language describing the series of events is confusing. When Lupicinus, the Roman official, heard what had happened outside the city, he took hold of all of Olivive's and Fritigern's attendants and had them executed. The Goths outside the city heard about this. They assumed that the Romans had also killed their two leaders, and they threatened to sack the city in response. Thinking quickly, Fritigern told Lupicinus that he was the only one who could calm the Tervingi outside Marcianople. Lupicinus let him go, but when Fritigern reached the main body of Goths, he didn't quiet them down. He did the opposite. He led them into open rebellion. Now let's return to our friend Vulfila. You've been driven from your home by the Huns and by political instability. Your leaders negotiated a deal in good faith with the Romans, and they failed to hold up their end of the bargain. Not only have they refused to provide the supplies they promised, you've seen friends and maybe even family members sold into slavery just to pay for some meager quantity of food. Now, with all of that stress and mistreatment on your mind, you think the Romans have tried to murder your leaders. What reasonable person or group of people wouldn't snap under those circumstances? We have to remember, too, that Vulfila and the other Tervingi who had been admitted into the empire weren't farmers or fishermen. They were professional warriors and ex-soldiers. The Romans might have disarmed them when they crossed the Danube, but they were far from helpless. If they'd been militarily useless, the Romans would never have admitted them anyway. These were supposed to be soldiers ready for recruitment into the army. While the Romans were distracted by the rapidly spiraling situation with the Tervingi, the Greuthungi, who had been refused entrance into the empire, took advantage of the absence of troops on the frontier and crossed the Danube. Unlike the Tervingi, they hadn't been disarmed, and they were presumably not suffering from starvation or ill treatment. Here's where things get interesting. Lupicinus pursued Fritigern and the Goths as they retreated from Marcianople, but the Goths slaughtered this Roman army, which probably wasn't an insignificant force, on the battlefield. They killed the officers and took their standards, a massive blow to the Roman army's pride, while Lupicinus himself fled the field. Let's pause for a moment and take stock, because this is where we have to begin to examine critically the idea of the Goths. Up to this point, we've been talking about one particular group of Tervingi who struck a deal with Valens to enter the empire. The Greuthungi, another group of Goths, have now entered without striking a deal. Now that Fritigern and the Tervingi have defeated the Romans, something else interesting happened. A unit of Gothic soldiers in the Roman army was stationed at Adrianople, a couple hundred miles south of Marcianople, for the winter. This group of soldiers received orders to cross over to Asia for a campaign Valens was planning to conduct against the Persians, and through a confused series of events, they ended up fighting a pitched battle with the citizens of Adrianople and taking the contents of the local imperial arms factory. When they were finished there, they moved north, joined forces with Fritigern and the Tervingi. Other sources tell us of slaves, some of whom were Goths who had been transported south of the border, running away to join the marauding Tervingi. What began as a rebellion among one group of barbarians quickly spread to other disaffected groups within the empire, along with foreigners who had crossed the border. We talked before about the increasing integration of the empire and the barbarian world. That goes both ways. There were plenty of people of barbarian, and in this case specifically Gothic, descent living south of the border. Many of them served in the army. Under the right circumstances, they proved to be tender, waiting for a spark. Lupicinus's behavior at the banquet and the mistreatment of the Tervingi proved to be that spark. The newly united Goths raided far and wide across the Balkan provinces of the empire and even down into Greece. They were becoming a serious problem for an imperial administration that was still more concerned with a potential war with Persia than with a bunch of down-on-their-luck Goths rampaging through backwater border provinces. That didn't last, though. In 377, the next year, an army came all the way from the Western Empire and fought the Goths to a draw in a major battle near the mouth of the Danube, but nothing else came of it, and the Western troops quickly returned home to leave the region to its fate. Again, we see the connections between the barbarian world and the Roman world, as a group of Huns and Alans, another group composed of horse-riding steppe nomads, allied themselves with the united Goths and came south of the frontier. With the Roman army unable to stop them, the Goths headed south into the rich province of Thrace and laid waste the whole area around Constantinople. Whatever the Romans had done to the Goths, there's no glossing over the fact that the Goths' efforts were destructive in the extreme. They burned, they robbed, they raped, they murdered, and above all, they took prisoners as slaves. The destruction was so severe that the region was effectively cut off from the outside world. An attempt to send a letter to one place within it never made it. And the emperor even relieved its tax burden in recognition of the widespread chaos and destruction. The Goths also won more than one victory over the Roman troops sent to contain them. Consider this account from Ammianus as an example. Quote, "The barbarians, however, like savage beasts that had broken their cages, poured raging over the wide extent of Thrace and made for a town called Dibaltum, where they found Barzimeres, tribune of the Targeteers, a leader experienced in the dust of warfare, with his own men, the Cornuti, and other companies of infantry, and fell upon him just as he was pitching his camp. He at once, as the exigency of imminent destruction compelled him, ordered the trumpet to sound the attack, and having protected his flanks, charged out at the head of his brave soldiers, who were ready and armed for battle. And by his valiant resistance, he would have withdrawn on equal terms, had not the charge of a large force of cavalry surrounded him when he was breathless from fatigue. And so he fell, having slain not a few of the barbarians, whose losses were concealed by their great numbers." Ammianus portrays this as a heroic last stand of a few outnumbered Roman troops. But it sounds a lot more like a substantial Roman detachment got caught unawares, was surrounded, and the Goths slaughtered them. Now remember, our friend Vulfila wasn't the only veteran of the Roman army, even among the Tervingi who had crossed the frontier, even leaving aside the army units that had defected and joined the Goths later on. They may have been joined by runaway slaves and other societal malcontents, and they may have had families and dependents with them, but it's essential to remember that this was first and foremost an army. As time went on, and they fought more battles and more skirmishes like the one Ammianus described, they didn't get worse at fighting. They got better. And that brings us to the shocking conclusion of this particular chain of events. Valens was finally beginning to take the Gothic threat seriously, and his troops had some success in picking off individual parties of raiders. We have to bear in mind that many groups of Goths would have been operating separately. It would have been next to impossible to keep an entire army and its dependents consistently supplied if they were all gathered together in one body. But in response to these Roman successes, Fritigern was forced to gather all the Goths together, and he prepared for Valens to come north with a Roman field army, something like 30 or 40,000 troops. Valens settled down and built a fortified camp around the outskirts of Adrianople, modern Edirne, to the west of Constantinople in European Turkey. Fritigern didn't particularly want to fight. Roman field armies, as opposed to the kinds of frontier troops who had overseen the Goths' entry into the empire, were the cream of the crop. They were the most experienced, they were the best trained, they were the best equipped soldiers fighting under the Roman banner. They were longtime professionals with years of war under their belts. Roman field armies weren't undefeated in open battle, but nobody would have gone into a fight with one of them thinking that they were the betting favorite. Our Vulfila wouldn't have had any illusions about this. He knew what fighting a Roman field army entailed, and the quality of the troops he would face, and so did many of his compatriots. Only the young and the foolish would have overestimated their chances, and by this point, Vulfila was neither. So Fritigern tried to negotiate. This wasn't a blood feud or war to the knife. The Goths were rational, if righteously angry, actors who knew that their raiding activities constituted leverage for the settlement deal they still hoped to reach. Remember, they weren't planning on going back across the frontier, and they couldn't hope to evade the Roman armies forever. They had plunder to spend. They had wives and children who needed safety. Eventually, a settlement would be a necessity for both sides. That's what Fritigern offered, but Valens wasn't interested. After the Goths had scuttled his planned campaign against the Persians while ravaging his territory, and he'd needed the aid of an army from the Western Empire to keep the Goths contained, Valens absolutely had to acquire a victory to bolster his prestige. The Western Emperor, Gratian, was on his way to the east with a substantial body of reinforcements to help quell the Gothic threat once and for all. As Valens was camped in Adrianople, an emissary from Gratian arrived with the news that the Western Emperor would arrive with his army shortly. Again, though, Valens needed a win. He got bad information from his scouts, who told him that there were only 10,000 Goths present, a massive underestimate. Still, Valens should have had a substantial advantage. Acting before Gratian arrived would leave Valens with all the glory. That was glory he badly needed to head off potential usurpations among troops and generals unimpressed with his military prowess. That That was a far greater threat for any Roman Empire or for any Roman emperor than any group of barbarians. And so the Romans advanced north the next day and found the Goths encamped on a low ridge, with their warriors drawn up in front of a wagon logger. If you've ever seen a Western movie where the settlers circle their wagons for protection against hostile Native Americans, that's exactly what this looked like, only on a much, much larger scale. Neither side was ready to fight right away. The Romans took a while to form up, while Fritigern tried to stall by asking one more time for a settlement. Fritigern, though, was just buying time for his cavalry to return. They were off raiding. It was a hot day, August 9th of 378, and these delays meant that the Romans were waiting under the hot sun for hours, while the Goths could be kept supplied with food and water from the wagon logger. The Goths made it even worse for the Romans by lighting fires in the fields around the ridge, which made a hot day even hotter. We can picture our friend Vulfila standing on the ridge waiting, sweat pouring from his brow, underneath a superheated iron helmet, and rivulets of sweat running from his armpits and down his back underneath a heavy coat of chainmail. Imagine the fear, the adrenaline coursing through his veins, knowing what was about to happen. One way or the other, it would be over soon. By the time the Romans got around to attacking, it was already the middle of the afternoon. They threw themselves up the ridge, and some units even reached all the way to the wagon logger. The fighting was fierce and went back and forth, but the Gothic cavalry eventually returned and struck the exhausted, dehydrated Romans in the flank to turn the tide of battle. Piece by piece, the Roman army broke, and the Goths pursued them back down the ridge and toward Adrianople. Thousands of dead Goths and Romans littered the field, but there was no question that this was a Gothic victory of epic proportions. Fully two-thirds of the Eastern Roman field army had been destroyed. And remember, this was the absolute cream of the crop, the best soldiers in the empire, and they simply couldn't be replaced. Valens was dead too, though how he met his end is unsure. He might have died on the field, or been burned to death in a farmhouse by the pursuing Goths who didn't know his identity. This was the biggest disaster to befall a Roman army in more than 350 years, and the most serious disaster to happen within the borders of the empire since Hannibal, nearly six centuries before, had rampaged his way through Republican Italy. An emperor had died on the field of battle along with his best troops, and there was nothing left to stop the Goths. The orator Themistius put it like this, quote, "Thrace was overrun, Illyricum was overrun, armies vanished altogether like shadows."
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great-tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great-tasting, high-quality organic dairy ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!"
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The historian Michael Kulikovsky recently summed up the impact of Adrianople on the Goths like this, and I think he hits the nail on the head. Quote, "For the empire, the Goths were one of dozens of barbarian neighbors, and by no means the most important. They were a marginal force even in the political life of the empire, and invisible in its social and institutional history. After 378, however, the Goths were a constant and central presence in the political life of the empire." Now, it's hard to tell precisely what happened in the aftermath of the Battle of Adrianople. The Goths besieged the city of Adrianople unsuccessfully, and then made an attempt on Constantinople, but failed there as well. The Romans struggled psychologically to deal with the shock of a major battlefield defeat and some commanders took extreme measures. The accounts are confused, but the rest of the Goths enrolled in the Eastern Army seem to have been massacred en masse. This would have been thousands of troops, all murdered to prevent further defections of the kind that had bolstered Fritigern's Tervingi. Surprisingly quickly, though, the Romans got the situation in hand. Gratian crowned a new Eastern emperor, Theodosius, and he was a highly competent military officer from a well-known family. Theodosius wasted no time in sealing off the Goths in the Balkan provinces, and slowly but surely, with many setbacks and defeats for the Romans, the Goths were worn down to the point where they had to come to the negotiating table. 3 years later, the war came to an end. Historians have spent a lot of time and energy trying to reconstruct this Treaty of 382, which has taken on outsized significance in the history of barbarians within the Roman Empire. Why? Because, in this reading, this was the first agreement of its type, the first settlement of barbarians negotiated with the Romans on relatively equal terms, the first treaty that preserved a barbarian group as a sovereign entity on Roman soil rather than integrating it. I think that's way, way, way overstated. The precedent here appears only in hindsight, and you've got to really want for this to be a thing to make it one. The sources are incomplete, and what they imply more than anything is closer to unconditional surrender on the part of the Goths than a neutral agreement. Is that really all that hard to believe? Again, think of Wulfila here. He's been fighting the Romans nonstop for the last 6 years. He's raided, he's fought in enormous battles and no-name skirmishes, ridden hundreds if not thousands of miles between the Danube and Greece, been pinned in the mountains in the winter by Roman troops, he's starved at times, he's watched friends and family die in the process. And, oh yeah, before that, he and his compatriots had fought another war against the Huns and been driven from their homes as refugees. Think about the physical toll this would have taken on Wulfila. For comparison, archaeologists recently found a set of human remains that belonged to a man who lived in the 6th century, so a bit later than Wulfila, but close enough to shed some light on him. This man, who was in his mid-40s when he died, the same age as our Wulfila in 382, was clearly a warrior. He had lost his left foot and had it replaced with a prosthetic, which is what garnered headlines, but it's the rest of his body that's really interesting. This man had broken his nose several times. He had arthritis in his shoulders, his hips, his left knee, and his spine. He had rotator cuff degeneration in his left shoulder. He had overused muscles in his hips and spine that speak to long hours over many, many years spent on horseback. He had suffered massive blunt force trauma to his right leg that eventually healed. And that's just what we can see on the bone. It's a safe bet that he didn't have a baby face either. Anybody who spent a lifetime around edged weapons would have had more than a few visible scars. That's exactly the kind of lifestyle our Wulfila had lived, and had lived nonstop for more than 10 years at this point. After a decade of nonstop war, it's no wonder that the Goths were ready to be done with it all. Precisely what this treaty in 382 AD entailed is hard to say. Many of the Goths seem to have settled down and taken up farming, which is more or less what they were supposed to do in this situation. It's more or less what they'd been asking for from the beginning. Others enlisted in the army. The form that army enlistment took is important for us to suss out, because it bears directly on the future of the Goths as a people, and on the story we're going to be telling in this podcast. Now, some historians see the Goths' military service taking the form of being called up en masse in a kind of semi-independent ethnic contingents, like a levy that would be imposed on the group as a whole in times of imperial need. I think that's a strained reading, though. What we see, insofar as the limited evidence allows us to see, are units of the regular army composed largely or entirely of Goths. The distinction between mass levies and the regular army is an artificial one, in my mind. After years of warfare on both sides of the frontier, could you even be considered a Goth without being a soldier in the army? Those two forms of identity, ethnic and professional, tied themselves ever more closely together. To be a Goth was to be a soldier. Now, many of the Gothic nobles and big men, the ones that we met beyond the frontier earlier, went on to distinguished careers in the Roman military as regular officers. This might sound surprising, but recall our consistent theme. The barbarian and Roman worlds were increasingly integrated, especially in the army. Men of Frankish or Alemannic descent could be found at the highest levels of the military in the middle of the 4th century, and now the Goths were just moving into that sphere as well. These were men with a lifetime of experience of soldiering for whomever provided the greatest rewards, and they had a taste for real power. Right now, the best opportunity to continue that lifestyle was in Roman service. Our friend Vulfila would have been among that group. He wasn't a farmer, and he never had been. What interest would that hold for him? Conversely, he'd spent his entire life as a soldier. Those were the skills he'd honed over 25 years on battlefields large and small, from Gaul to Thrace and maybe even to Persia. Vulfila can't have been sentimental about joining the army he'd spent 6 years fighting. After all, he'd fought in it before. Above all, we have to see people like Vulfila and the other Goths who joined the Roman army as professional soldiers. They came from a background that led them to develop that skill set, a social context that encouraged it, and then they spent their entire adult lives trying to find ways to put it to use for maximum reward. In a roundabout way, this leads us back to the theme of last week's episode. The barbarian world and the Roman world were deeply intertwined. I highly doubt it would have occurred to Vulfila or the other Goths to think of the war between 376 and 382 as an ethnic conflict between Goths and Romans. Instead, they were parties who were always, at every point, looking for a way to come to an accommodation. Violence was the language through which they expressed that disagreement. Eventually, they found enough common ground, through mutual exhaustion, to move on to a more cooperative relationship. Goths and Romans weren't natural enemies, and again, this wasn't blood feud. These 6 years between 376 and 382 fundamentally changed what we mean when we say the Goths. The group that settled in the Balkans and joined the regular army in large numbers in 382 wasn't the same as the Tervingi who had crossed the Danube in 376. They'd added the Greuthungi of Alathius and Saphrax, and the defecting Gothic units of the Roman army, not to mention the runaway slaves and other poor folks who had joined up over the course of the campaigns. Thousands would have died, and the experience of raiding, fighting, and being on the run for half a decade has to have changed how these people thought of themselves and their group identity. So what I'm saying is, beware any historian who tries to draw a simple, direct line from the Goths beyond the frontier to the Goths who will eventually, in 30 years, sack Rome. The immigrant experience, not to mention the group-wide traumas we've discussed in today's episode, fundamentally changed expressions of ethnicity and belonging. I would argue that as a group, fundamentally, the Goths' identity became more and more and more militarized, an acceleration of the process we began discussing last week beyond the frontier. And the consequences of that will stretch well into the future. The relationship with Rome and Romans grew closer and more complex, a continuation of the theme we've now reinforced in two consecutive episodes. In the next episode, we'll dive even further into this vein as we follow the Goths from their settlement in the Balkans to the sack of the eternal city of Rome itself. Thank you for listening to this week's episode, and again, my apologies for the delay between episode 2 and episode 3. You can follow me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman and hit me up if you ever want to talk about any of this stuff. You can find me on Facebook at Patrick Wyman MMA if you want to follow me there too. Again, thank you for listening.
Jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig. Inspiring kid confidence.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.